UK government might have shut down?
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
Good morning, folks. I'm Roland Martin. Coming up on this special edition of News One Now, we'll focus on the legacy of President Barack Obama. As the 44th president of the United States leaves office in about 5 hours, we'll discuss his handling of a wide range of issues that are important to African Americans, from the economy and jobs to health care to HBCUs to housing. We'll also assess the legacy of the nation's first African American First Lady, Michelle Obama. Folks, we've got a jam-packed show with insight and analysis from an all-star panel. The first, the legacy of President Barack Obama, starts right now. The presidency of the nation's first black president, Barack Hussein Obama, officially ends today at noon. When a man with a very different vision for America, Donald Trump, is sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. When I interviewed President Barack Obama 1 year into his first term in January of 2010, he laid out his vision for governing as the nation's first black president.
The basic principle is, A, that we are aspiring to universal opportunity, that if we do the right thing on health care, we do the right thing on education, that's going to help African Americans and Latinos more, only because they're further behind, but it's not because we're targeting them on the basis of race. There will be some circumstances in which, for example, closing the achievement gap, we should pay special attention to the fact that, you know, we can't afford to have African American children, you know, graduating from high school with 8th grade reading levels, because that's our future workforce, and that's going to be bad for everybody. And I think the African American community, like every community, should say we've got some particular problems that need redress. And the Congressional Black Caucus appropriately should be focused on some of the majority in their communities that are really hurting. The only difference I would have would be if it is framed in terms of just helping one racial group or one ethnic group, as opposed to helping everybody. Some groups may need some particular help because they're so far behind. But the more we frame this as Americans who are coming together to get things done and to encourage each other's success, the better off we're going to be. I've been the first one to say that my election didn't represent the end of racial controversies or the solution to race relations in this country. We've been dealing with this for hundreds of years. We've got a legacy of slavery, of Jim Crow, of discrimination. There are still suspicions and stereotypes that linger in our culture. Those things aren't going to go away overnight. I don't think anybody expects them to. I think that what we can honestly say is that progress has been made. I'm in the Oval Office. You are able to do an interview for a black-owned TV station. Those are things that didn't exist, not just 50 years ago, didn't exist 15 years ago. And so obviously things have changed, but that doesn't mean that there's not still going to be the need for constant evolution on the part of the country so that there's greater understanding, greater empathy. People are not subject to some of the sensitivities that they are right now because everybody feels like they've got an equal stake in our society. We're not there yet. I think we're going to get there. I think it's nice that African American kids around the country can say to themselves, you know, maybe I can aspire to be president too. I think that's worth something. I think it indicates the progress we've made and the openness that American society has to judging people on the merits. But the bottom line is I still have to perform as president. And you know, if after having gone through the worst financial crisis and recession since the Great Depression, we are not rebuilding this economy in a way that's more fair, more just, provides greater employment opportunities. If I have not succeeded in that, then I think people are right to be frustrated and right to be angry. The only thing I ask, not just from African Americans, but from all Americans, is to understand where we start from. We started in a deep hole. You know, it always amuses me when I hear Republicans talking about, look at all this debt and deficit that he's accumulated. Well, time out. The overwhelming portion of the debt that was accumulated when we were not in recession, but in economic growth mode for 8 years. Bill Clinton left a surplus that got ran into trillions of dollars of debt and a $1.3 trillion deficit that I inherited. So hold me responsible for what am I now doing to solve that problem. But don't act like, you know, I just landed here, you know, with a blank slate. The same is true when it comes to employment. When I was sworn in January 20th, it turned out that we had just lost 650,000 jobs in December of 08, lost another 700,000 in January of 09 before I had even figured out where the bathrooms were in the West Wing, and had lost another 650,000 in March before our plans even had started to be implemented. So the bulk of the 7 million jobs that we lost this year occurred before our plans had any opportunity to get going. As long as people understand that, the baseline from which we were starting, then I feel very comfortable being judged by what we produce.
All right, folks, I'm going to begin our conversation this way. So in 2009, I interviewed Reverend Al Sharpton for Ebony Magazine's Power Issue, and we talked about how do you assess the legacy of President Obama? What should we as African Americans look to? And so this is what he said in 2009.
How do you measure it? You measure it by the index level in society. Where are we in health care compared to the general population? Where are we in education? Where are we in our medium income level? Where are we in terms of our ability to develop our families? Same way you measure everybody in society. The goal was to have equal access, equal opportunity, and equal protection under the law. As long as we go to jail three times more for the same crime, the same criminal background, as long as we're number one in the 9 worst diseases in the country, as long as our schools don't function, we're not there yet. Very simple. So with all the drama, whether we're going to march, whether we're going to go to the cocktail party and lobby, whatever we're going to do, at the end of the day, if that data hasn't changed, we have not made progress. If the data has changed, then we've made progress. That's how you measure it. Because let me tell you a little secret to the Ebony readers. We got a 4 to 8 year lease in the White House. We didn't get the deed. The day will come when Obama's not there anymore. And the generations behind us will measure us by those index levels. I remember in 1989, we elected a black mayor in New York, right? Gorgeous mosaic. We thought that the world had changed upside down. 4 years later, they put him out of City Hall. The index level of blacks in the city hadn't changed. I've seen this movie before. You got to use the openings to change the level of life. Otherwise, you will have a moment of joy that will be immediately followed by despair if you don't understand it's an opening. It's like a football game. You see an opening, you run to score. If you just celebrate the opening, you're going to get tackled.
Roland.
Dr. Jason Johnson.
He is absolutely correct. And by that definition, I would grade Obama maybe a C+. There are some areas that improved. There are some areas where he could have made a much better legacy than he did it. You look at issues like civil rights, civil liberties. He didn't really do all that much. He pretty much advanced the kinds of things Bush did. We had domestic spying. We had that sorts of issues. You look at domestic policing issues. There were some surface things that were done. Not enough convictions, not enough changes. He left a lot of points on the field by not putting in a lot of judges, certainly in these last couple of days when he could, when Congress was on recess. Were there some health care improvements? Sure. You look at financially, no. I mean, with 40-something percent of African-American wealth lost during the Great Recession, primarily through housing, there was not nearly enough effort put in.
53%.
53%, exactly. There was not nearly enough targeted effort put in to help black people regain their footing that was lost during the Great Recession. So I give him a C+.
Angela.
So I think this is really interesting. I first want to kind of flag some of the challenges that he was up against. One, of course, is unprecedented Republican obstruction. That said, that does not mean that he did all that he could and left nothing out. That's a sermon that my pastor once preached. when I think about the clemency initiative that was run out of the Department of Justice, the fact that he's conservatively used pardons, but he has overwhelmingly used commutations mm-hmm. to ensure that there is some type of parity within CJ reform, but also the fact that a Republican Congress wouldn't take up a criminal justice reform bill. When I think about him pushing an American Jobs Act that could never even get consideration on the House floor, and now we're talking about what types of deals Democrats could broker with the Donald Trump when they just wholeheartedly ignored this. When I think about the fact that the Congressional Black Caucus went on a jobs initiatives tour to deal with black unemployment that was sky high and one of the most tense moments we had with this president. And then I look at where unemployment is now.
And the Black Caucus got attacked for that
right.
because they got ripped to shreds by saying, how dare y'all That's speak right. against the president.
That's right.
I know I was the executive yeah. director at the time. But I think that it just demonstrates how much of a balancing act this was, mm-hmm. how much of a tightrope black folks had to walk. We had to be careful utilizing our platforms and criticizing mm-hmm. the president. And it's frustrating because I also think of things he said, like, if you want something done, make me do it. He talked about a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, we ain't got no damn boat. Mm-hmm. So there are all of these other challenges that exist. And so it's not a 30-second answer I could give right. you. It's probably a book.
Brett?
Well, I would say, I mean, along these same lines, I think Barack Obama miscalculated. I think there was a heavy overinvestment in the politics of personality. Mm-hmm. The Democratic Party looks like it's in shambles. And now he wants to lead the next iteration of building a force? No, bruh, you had your chance. And I didn't know TV1 had a time machine rolling for you to actually have that interview with Al Sharpton 8 years ago. But he doesn't even have that much bass in his voice anymore. That's a different Al Sharpton that we've seen over the last 8 years. But I'm speaking to a very important point. What was the relationship of Barack Obama to organized black political movements and leadership? The CBC distancings we hear. Bringing in people and saying anyone who's critical of the president, including some viewers probably watching this now, you can't be critical of President Obama. No, it's our obligation. And for him to borrow that language from Franklin Roosevelt and previous generation, make me do it. And then to go on lecture tours when he did deal with black people, his annual let me talk to black people speech, therefore, and chastise us over and over again, this man miscalculated. So I don't know. I don't know, Doc. I might give him a C. I might give him a D plus.
Lauren?
You know, it's hard to give him a grade on this. Angela makes a really good point. We can never forget when we talk about this president, he dealt with historic obstruction like we have never seen
right.
in American history. There's no doubt about that. When we look at the hard data, though, when we look at the unemployment rate for African Americans, as Angela brought up, you know, it hit 16.7 in late 2011. The CBC goes on a job tour. The White House gets pissed off about it. Well, that 16.7 was a 28-year high, highest since Ronald Reagan. Now, he did get it back down to 8.1, which is where it is now, which is very commendable. But if you look at Bush's lowest number, it's 7.6 in 2007. Clinton's lowest numbers were in the sevens. And, you know, at his first press conference, he was asked about this. Are you going to do targeted help for African Americans? He didn't do it. I don't expect the president to do everything, but I do expect Hilda Solis or somebody to come out and say something. We look at the high school graduation.
She was labor secretary.
She was labor secretary and said absolutely nothing about black unemployment.
But the reality is, not true. The problem is they didn't put her out other places. She appeared on this show more than anywhere else.
Well,
so I'm just saying, I mean, because during Washington Watch.
The White House wanted to act like black unemployment, the issue didn't exist. When it comes to specific help for African Americans, they get real quiet.
I got to go. Hold tight 1 second. I got to go to break. What I want folks to understand is that this, folks, is not meant to be a big celebration. It really is to look at the data, as Reverend Sharpton talked about, and also Marc Morial, the National Urban League. And speaking of that, when we come back, we'll hear from Marc Morial as they give their grades to the president on the issues Angela mentioned of criminal justice reform and those issues. So we'll talk about that in our next segment on our special, the first President Barack Obama's presidency right here on News One Now on TV One. We'll be back in just a moment.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
President Obama was confronted with multiple crises as he entered office, not to mention a series of violent tragedies and racially charged incidents that took place on his watch, including the death of Trayvon Martin. Then you talk about Freddie Gray. You talk about Mike Brown. You talk about Eric Garner, Ayanna Jones. You talk about Rekia Boyd. You can go on and on and on. This presidency will also be defined by the rise of Black Lives Matter. Let's go back to our panel on this. When you talk about criminal justice reform, look, Attorney General Eric Holder played a critical role changing the rules when it came to prosecutions, right, saying, look, you're not going to get promoted or your promotion is not going to be based upon how many more people you get put in jail for how long. That was critical. Then you talk about, again, with the president, Angela, as you mentioned earlier, how he used commutations more than any other president. How do we assess this president's legacy when it comes to criminal justice reform and also dealing with police issues such as police brutality and then weaving in Black Lives Matter?
I mean, look, there was also an increase in consent decrees. After some consistent complaining, he actually did change the law so that you don't have a bunch of Mayberry cops in Ferguson getting access to military hardware every 15 minutes. There were some things that he did that were substantive improvements. There were things that he looked at that no other president had cared about before.
Such as?
Not only with the Gulf War equipment, the consent decrees, that was major. Clinton had come up with consent decrees in the 90s, and Bush had hardly ever used them at all. And the fact that they were trying to rush some in at the last couple minutes in cities like Baltimore, that was an improvement. That was something that I was particularly impressed with when it comes to Obama.
Lauren, on this whole issue, when you talk about what Greg mentioned earlier, the President Roosevelt comment to A. Philip Randolph, Philip, make me do it. You saw that even with Black Lives Matter. When he met with many of those leaders, they sat in the Oval Office and challenged this president. They were not just enamored with being in the Oval Office, but he also early on caught the wrath of white America when he was asked a question at a news conference. And it was this question here, folks, dealing with the issue of Skip Gates being arrested by Cambridge, Massachusetts police.
I don't know, not having been there and not seeing all the facts, what role race played in that. But I think it's fair to say, number one, any of us would be pretty angry. Number two, that the Cambridge police acted stupidly in arresting somebody when there was already proof that they were in their own home.
So, Lauren, on that particular point there, that was an example of the president speaking honestly about race, about police issues, and white America. Oh my God, the backlash was real.
Right. Yeah, obviously being the first Black president of the United States, he's had to deal with these issues of trying to balance both sides for his entire presidency. I happen to think in the first few years he really sort of overcommitted to the side of trying to be too cautious. The Skip Gates thing was an unfortunate example of that. But he got better as he went along. Unfortunately, it shouldn't have taken, you know, 9 people getting murdered in South Carolina for that to get better. Because there's some obvious statements of fact that needed to happen. But it was good to see the advocacy, the acceptance of the young advocates into the White House. That had not happened before. I think the White House should be commended for having them in because, you know, usually it's the same. You know, they were sort of going through the motions in the first 3 years. They would have Sharpton, Morial, and Ben Jealous, and, okay, we'll have the Black meeting, and then that was about it. And then they really did have some more acceptance of the younger leaders as they went on. Yeah.
Angela, we also saw a significant change in federal judiciary, and that is the appointments he made in terms of those judgeships, but he also got criticized when it came to the Supreme Court, not interviewing any Black women. He made 3 appointments. 2 of them were actually confirmed. I was extremely critical here, saying appoint a Black woman.
Yes.
When Scalia died, I felt that could have put a level of pressure on the senators.
Absolutely.
Where they could have potentially even had the actual confirmation hearing.
Right.
Putting up Merrick Garland did nothing. That also could have actually, and still in my opinion, fired up younger voters.
Yes.
In anticipation of the election as well. And so when you also weave in that also is an important part of the legacy, the federal bench.
No, there's no question about it. I think, again, this contrast is, I think it really does demonstrate the challenges that we experienced in both supporting and loving our president and cheering for him and also having to challenge him. So when I think about this Supreme Court moment, this is one of the most infuriating for me. I was devastated by that. I was frustrated by that.
And Black leadership, Angela, they were way too silent, and they acquiesced.
I was more livid with Black leadership and civil rights organizations than I was with the president, because if we do have an obligation to make him do it, you don't have an obligation to tweet support for Merrick Garland, whom many of us had never even heard of.
Right.
I think the bigger issue for me is you contrast that with where you started, Trayvon Martin, and him finally getting to the point where he goes to the Rose Garden and says, Trayvon Martin could have been me.
Okay, let me give y'all some insight, okay? because this had not been revealed. That morning on the Tom Jordan Morning Show, we discussed it. Y'all might remember that weekend they had all of those can light vigils, and it was hoodie up on Sunday. I called the White House, and I talked to Valerie Jarrett, and I said, y'all about to get left behind. I said, y'all better come out and say something. They said, well, we don't really want to get involved in this whole deal because of, you know, this whole issue in terms of there's an investigation. I said, no, you're about to get left behind by Black America, and y'all better get on it.
I got a call
2 hours later, said, be sure to watch the news conference in the Rose Garden.
There were several conversations like that, and I think my only point here is you contrast that very important moment, and did you bring up Charleston?
Yeah, so Lauren did.
When you think about that, and you think about that Amazing Grace moment, and then you contrast that with the Supreme Court, I mean, we literally are going through
symbolism issue there, though. Symbols over substance.
I don't think it's fair to say there's no substance.
The judicial appointments are historic. He has appointed more black judges than anybody, but you're right, the Merrick Garland thing was extremely angering.
20 years from now, forget Elena Kagan. I mean, I do this with my students over at Howard Law. 20 years from now, we may be looking at Sonia Sotomayor as one of the most important things he did as regards to the law.
Right.
Depending on, because Sonia Sotomayor has not shrunk. In fact, the first place she visited after her appointment was Howard Law School. And she's been over there several times. Yeah. She really is remarkable. Yeah. And even though she speaks Spanish and from the Bronx, Boricua, that's about as close to a black woman as
Jason, real quick, I'll tell you, when he named Elena Kagan, that was a lot of pressure put on civil rights groups to come out in support of her. Mark Morial was the only one that first week who would not accede to that. And in fact, we had Washington Watch, we had people who were on the show that we taped it on a Friday. Mm-hmm. Valerie Jarrett was on our show that Friday. They put pressure on the NAACP and Reverend Sharpton to come out that weekend to endorse her. And I gave a speech, commencement speech at University of Maryland, University College. And we'd already taped the show. Mm-hmm. And I got a phone call when I got off that stage. Hey, we just got the NAACP's endorsement in Sharpton. Can we somehow squeeze into the show? I mean, so that was one of those deals where black pressure, I mean, got to them, and they were scrambling to get black folks to line up behind Elena Kagan. Well, 30 seconds.
Yeah, and it's questionable because Elena Kagan didn't have the greatest record of hiring or retention of black people in her position. But I think that's one of those things that the biggest complaint I've always had about Obama is power. He still left 100 judges on the table. There were recess appointments that he could have made. There was a recess appointment he could have made for the Supreme Court. He didn't do it. There was so much more he could have done in criminal justice.
He got slapped back for
the Supreme Court. On a previous
National Labor Board.
But that went to the Supreme Court.
He could have done it.
And they said he overreached on that. And so there was some hesitancy. Yeah.
He could have forced the issue.
But there was some hesitancy there because he'd already done that once.
Exactly.
All right, folks, hold tight 1 second. We come back. We'll talk up next on President Obama's legacy special, The Signature Achievement. Republicans have already begun to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. We'll discuss that next right here at News One Now, TV One.
When minority groups voice discontent, they're not just engaging in reverse racism or practicing political correctness. When they wage peaceful protests, they're not demanding special treatment, but the equal treatment that our founders promised.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
President Obama succeeded where 7 of his predecessors, both Democrats and Republicans, failed in the effort to provide universal health care coverage. The Affordable Care Act, known more commonly as Obamacare, for some crazy reason, was a hard-won victory that is already being overturned by Donald Trump and the Republican Congress. I recently spoke with Daniel Dawes, a health care attorney and the author of 150 Years of Obamacare, about the impact a repeal can have on Americans.
You know, one of the confusions that we are seeing, and you've heard reported, is that many folks who voted for President-elect Trump actually, and who are beneficiaries of the Obamacare program, many of them didn't realize that they were actually benefiting from Obamacare. So, you know, I understand your point about perhaps we shouldn't have embraced it, but I think maybe a mistake was that even in Democratic-led states, the governors were Democrats who were establishing their own exchanges, they shouldn't have run away from it too much, I think, because now folks didn't even realize, gee, my Affordable Care Act was actually Obamacare.
But in talking about this, I mean, clearly this is going to be one of his most important, thing he accomplished as president. But do you also believe they failed to properly sell it? And he's even talked about that, that they did not, frankly, explain it, champion it. And so you left it up to the critics to frame the narrative.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So, you know, President Obama, actually, when you talk about his legacy, he's the only presidential candidate ever to have said he was going to prioritize racial and ethnic health disparities in a health reform proposal. And he did so in the Affordable Care Act. So now we have the most comprehensive health reform law ever that addresses health disparities among racial and ethnic groups and other vulnerable groups. But the issue lies, though, with, yes, we lost the PR battle. And I think we lost it because opponents were able to outspend us during the negotiations 7-1. And then afterwards, they more than doubled their money to oppose this law, to undermine and to bring it in, put it in a negative light.
When we Daniel, when we think about the Affordable Care Act moving forward, obviously yes. You see what Republicans are trying to do right now. You were one of those architects of it. Can they actually repeal it and replace it? This whole idea of improve it, can it? I mean, you know, how can they say, oh no, it's going to be totally different. Everybody's going to get insured. Kids are going to be covered. Pre-existing conditions. But that sounds like the current plan.
So you remember right before the election, a lot of folks thought that Republicans were blowing hot air when they said they were going to repeal. Well, I argued differently and said it's happened before. We know that it's happened before in the past, and it can happen again. And so, yes, they can dismantle it, and they're doing so through the budget reconciliation process, which, as you know, and many of your viewers know, is a way to get at the budgetary provisions of the law, the taxes in the law. So that means that everyone that has insurance through the health insurance exchange or the marketplace and are getting subsidies, they stand to lose. And this is 80% of the folks in the insurance market. They stand to lose those subsidies. Anyone who has gotten insurance through Medicaid with a Medicaid expansion, they stand to lose coverage as well. So they can undermine the ACA in a significant manner, even though they may leave what we call the more popular provisions, as you articulated very well in the beginning of the segment. So there is a real worry because we know that African Americans stand to lose. There are about 3 million African Americans who have gained insurance through the exchanges, and their insurance is in jeopardy. And in all, we know that 30 million people stand to lose coverage, not just the 20 million that have gained insurance, but 30 million. So why is this a big deal? When you look at the Republican proposals, though, just want to take a minute to highlight for your viewers what's really at stake here. At the best case scenario, 15.5 million people or more stand to lose coverage. And at the worst case scenario, we're looking at the 30 million standing to lose coverage.
And every single one of these Republican
repeal and replacement plans that are out there actually have been shown to increase the cost. So if people are really upset about cost right now with premium deductibles and co-pays and others, they're going to be in for a real sticker shock if this repeal takes place.
All right, folks, so let's break it down with our panel here. Jason Johnson, Angela Rye, Greg Carr, Law and Victoria Burke. Affordable Care Act, huge, great impact on African Americans as well. The number of black folks I've talked to who said, man, I have family members who never had health insurance. Folks who said, finally, my children are also on my health care. This is, will no doubt, will be the most important achievement of his 8 years as president.
You know, this brings back, I think, an interesting point of intersection to Lauren's last immediate point, which is about symbolism. And I think that this is the time where symbolism and policy really meet. So the fact that a black president could ensure and then make sure that all of our folks would get coverage is huge. I think that this is one space where that's worked out really, really well. Of course, we haven't seen that same type of intersection work when it comes down to electing new folks and even turning out for elections where he's not on the ballot. But I think this is one signature achievement where that intersection matters.
If it wasn't for white Southern governors, there'd be more people covered.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
The president, to me, this is his second biggest achievement after killing Osama bin Laden, the health care bill. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He did choose health care over jobs in his first 2 years, and a lot of people thought that was a mistake, but actually looking back, it was the smartest thing in the world.
Because if this had not been done that first year, it was not going to happen.
Right. Here's the thing. It's a lot like the stimulus. One of the reasons the president didn't get enough credit for the stimulus is because, well, people can't tell what didn't happen,
also,
right?
Also, they failed to sell it, and he's admitted. No, but he's admitted, you know what? We didn't
Sell it.
Exactly. And the thing is, I was in Ohio. Like, we saw, there were signs on everything from the stimulus. He should have done that at more different places. But I tell you this, one of the greatest indicators of Obama's legacy is going to be after the Republicans destroy the ACA, and we will see a sharp, sharp contrast in coverage, the economy, and right. everything by 2018, 2020. This, him being sandwiched between George W. Bush, who no one liked when he left office, and Donald Trump, who no one likes coming into office, when they destroy that legacy, that'll be the clearest thing as to how great his
Do you really think they're going to destroy it? I mean, let's be clear. You're right. The first 2 years, that's basically where you see Barack Obama do everything he can.
Got it. Yeah.
Everything since then has been a reaction. I don't know that they're going to be able to reverse engineer something that was their plan to begin
well,
with.
Well, they will try.
They will try. They will try.
Look, they're going to. It's going to come down to 3 senators.
They're going to keep trying to pull it apart like Jenny. Yeah. The whole thing's going to be a mess. And then by 2018, they're going to try and delay it and claim that something else is going to happen.
All right, folks, hold tight 1 second. Up next in our News One Now special, we'll talk about the issue of President Barack Obama and HBCUs and housing. The National Urban League gave some grades in that area. We'll tell you what Mark Morial had to say and discuss that with our panel. Two HBCU professors, they kind of have a view on this. That's next on our News One Now special. Look back on the legacy of President Barack Obama.
Your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America.
I don't bend, I don't break.
It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
Plus, we're back discussing the legacy of President Barack Obama with our panel. We have, of course, Dr. Jason Johnson, Angela Rye, Dr. Greg Carr, Law and Victoria Burke. All right, I interviewed Mark Morial. The National Urban League put together their report in terms of where they offered grades to the president. Overall, they graded him excellent. One of the areas where they also graded him on was housing, where he got a failing grade on housing. And so here's what Mark Morial had to say about that.
We got no traction on what we thought it was necessary to bring back Black home ownership, and that would have been at the very beginning a principal reduction plan. And small business lending and minority business, if you will, overall emphasis we felt was lacking.
All right, folks, on the area of housing, this is one area where I have been highly critical of this administration from day one. 53%, as I said earlier, 53% of Black wealth lost to the housing foreclosure crisis. In the first days of his presidency, first 30, 60 days, they went to Arizona to announce the HAMP program, supposed to help 3 million people, only helped about 700,000. And this is where Black folks got hurt the most. Our wealth was impacted. In fact, even the ability for us to get small business loans was impacted because we didn't have the collateral.
Exactly.
And so we saw $23 billion in loans handed out. We only got $385 million. This, and I don't care what anybody says, y'all can go check the record.
Mm-hmm.
This is where from day one, I hit this administration and say, you must do something. And they simply failed
in housing. He had the
lowest
rate of borrowing for Black businesses of, I think, any president. We can't find anything lower than 1.7. It's embarrassing. This president is not good at issues with regard to poverty at all. It doesn't talk about, didn't talk about poverty very much over 8 years. We have 38% of Black children in poverty. Doesn't like to talk about that issue, and I'm not sure why, because you can't, you know, blame a sitting president. We did have over 40 million people in poverty when he took office, so it's not
we
as if you get blamed for that. But he had no, right, he had no policy for it.
And let's be perfectly clear. The reason you had the housing crisis was because of what took place the previous 10, 20 years when you had the whole issue of the subprime loans. But you had civil rights activists and African American activists who were saying, do a moratorium on foreclosures.
Yes.
Also, force the banks. I had Sean Donovan, the HUD secretary, on this show. I said, how did you agree to a policy where the banks voluntarily will rework loans?
Right.
They had no intentions in doing it. And in fact, what happened? They took TARP funds, they actually saved themselves, and did nothing, frankly, when it came to saving folks when it comes to homes. Angela.
So, a couple of things here, and again, drawing a contrast. So, there's also something that the CBC did that the president later took credit for because he realized how important it was. That was the creation of offices of minority and women inclusion in every financial services agency in the federal government. I think that we will see the long-term impact of that.
It's
not one that has immediate impact. Now, that is major.
Black people,
No, I can't.
This is why it's important. Black people at home, I need to help y'all. When the CBC fought for that, the White House fought them on that.
Yeah.
And in fact, y'all gotta say, I got a phone call late at night saying, hey, you know, are you gonna talk about this on Tom Jordan tomorrow? I said, no, I'm gonna talk about it on Monday. And what ended up happening was they fought for it. They withheld their votes in the House Financial Services bill.
In the
they fought to keep it in the bill. But here's what's crazy.
It ended black, up in that African American's accomplishments report.
Black folks still ripped them on that very
deal. It don't matter.
But I'm making the point.
I hear you.
Black people ripped the CBC for fighting for $4 billion.
I understand. And you'll see the impact of it later. Here's my contrast, now that he just took all my little shine. The contrast is black asset managers. And the fact that the president had so much in his power to do to ensure that there were opportunities for black asset managers in TARP going through the Treasury Department. Mm. Those protections were not there. That is something that the CBC members on financial services also fought for.
And Greg, let me say this here, Jason, he's on that particular point, 2010, I'm at a meeting with the Department. I'm at a meeting with the Department of Treasury in 2010, and I'm told that black firms outperform white majority firms on the management of TARP funds. My response was, are they going to get to manage more money? And it was silent. So to your point, black folks in Hispanic firms outperform and did not get more money to manage.
And here's what we're seeing with that lack of money, lack of access, and lack of loans. All these conversations we're having now about gentrification, you can see it on H Street in D.C., and all these different parts of the country.
Yes, sir.
Black people in Gen X and millennials, we are not in a position to buy the homes of our aging grandparents, which are now being bought right from under us for millions of dollars and flipped over and eliminating black neighborhoods throughout the country.
Got to go to HBCUs here. Yes. National Urban League gave him a grade of I believe it was fair. I told Mark he was dead wrong. This was a contentious issue. This was a contentious issue for all of his 8 years. They gave him a fair.
And Greg,
the Parent Plus loan deal.
Okay, let's walk across the bridge.
Go ahead.
The two things are related. I mean, everything you've been talking about in terms of access to capital, in terms of being able to hold on to your home. And then on the HBCU side, the Plus loan debacle makes it almost impossible for many folks to come out to be able to even afford to go to school. I mean, you know, Jason, you're at a public HBCU, Morgan State. That should be affordable. I'm at Howard University. We have kids now who literally could not come back to school. Yeah. And it took pressure. And forget the White House Office of HBCUs, which was just about moribund. It was ridiculous. Even William Harvey came out to criticize.
And that was shocking.
It was worse to be at Morehouse when President Obama sat there and spoke to Morehouse graduates and lectured them about how they needed to work hard. I was like, half the brothers who come here at graduation now are because you gutted the plus one loan.
That's right.
And all too many African-American leaders didn't want to criticize him for that.
Lauren, you reported this when he met with the CBC, and he said in that meeting, and folks, y'all can get mad all y'all want to, he said, if these HBCUs can't graduate these kids, they should shut down. That ticked off every CBC member sitting in that room.
The president has the attitude, and fortunately, it's very unfortunate for the first black president to have done this, but he had the attitude that HBCUs, for some reason, had to perform magic. I mean, these are schools who take on the toughest students.
Right.
He cost them $150 million and interrupted the education of 28,000 kids because of some, you know, parent plus loan decision to make the loans harder so you couldn't get a loan. And then they want to lecture and patronize black parents and say, we're saving you from yourselves. It was the worst piece of policy for this administration. It was embarrassing, and it's part of his permanent legacy.
So, really quickly, I think the other thing that was an affront to HBCUs is the two-year free college program that it never got off the ground.
Right.
But it would have been a detriment to historically black colleges.
All right, folks, again, I told y'all, we've been honest on this show. We've covered, let me be perfectly clear. Well, no, I'm going to say that for my final comment. We come back on the legacy of Michelle Obama and how she redefined what it means to be a First Lady of the United States.
For all the young people in this room and those who are watching, know that this country belongs to you, to all of you, from every background and walk of life. If you or your parents are immigrants, know that you are part of a proud American tradition, the infusion of new cultures, talents, and ideas, generation after generation, that has made us the greatest country on earth.
So you want the truth? Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News One Now.
Michelle LaVon Robinson,
girl of the South Side. For the past 25 years, you have not only been my wife and mother of my children, you have been my best friend. You took on a role you didn't ask for, and you made it your own with grace and with grit and with style and good humor.
Folks, that was President Barack Obama saluting his wife, First Lady Michelle Obama, at his farewell address in Chicago. Well, the moment she became First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama reshaped the role into something the country had never seen before. When I interviewed her during her husband's 2008 presidential campaign, she talked about the possibility of being the first black FLOTUS, the importance of her family, and how she became the number one supporter of her husband's decision to seek the presidency.
But at every turn, I had to sort of step back from the sort of personal sacrifice that fueled my initial response, and think more broadly, and think about the future, and think about the kind of world that I would want for my girls. I mean, at the very heart of my motivation for supporting Barack is my girls, and the kind of world that I want to hand over to them, and the kind of people that I want to lead the world. And when I think about that broader scheme, I think there's nobody in this world that I would want, nobody with the kind of character, the intellect, the capacity, than Barack. So I started thinking, well, the sacrifice I'm making is nothing compared to what we can do for these kids. So here we are. You know, I've never defined myself solely by my jobs. I've had many wonderful careers, and I don't view this as a step back or a huge compromise from a career perspective. I mean, I'm doing some phenomenal things supporting this campaign, and I'm certainly not bored. So that hasn't been as much of a challenge for me. You know, I've been really spending a lot of time trying to make sure that our household stays normal. That's the thing that keeps me up at night. Barack and I, no matter what is gone on in the day, when we talk at night, our conversation is about our daughters. How are they doing? How are they feeling? Are they happy? What's going on in their world? And I think I'm like any mother in that regard, is that I'm trying to keep them grounded. And that's always a challenge. If I were working full-time at my job that paid the health care, I would be worrying about the same thing. When other black women see me, they recognize themselves in me. You know, whether it's my shape, the way I dress, the way I walk, that reaffirms us. I think about how many people fought and died and struggled and sacrificed. That's another reason why I stopped the pity party about me and this race and what it would do to us. Because basically the sacrifice that we're making is nothing compared to all those who made it possible for us to even be sitting here, breathing in and out. And I have met so many people on these rope lines who break down in tears, people who saw this history, and they have fallen to their knees, just thankful that they're alive to see the day. It's powerful.
All right, folks, so let's break that down. Angela, I will start with you. Public policy-wise, you can think about Eleanor Roosevelt, you can think about Hillary Clinton and others as well. Michelle Obama purposely said, look, I'm not, y'all can deal with the politics. But she gradually, when you talk about her Let's Move initiative, you talk about how she has changed school lunch menus. People hate it, but now you have the calorie counts in restaurants as well. And so that is going to be, I believe, 20, 30 years from now, when they look back on the Obama presidency, that issue of nutrition and obesity, she'll get the credit for it.
I think that and what she's done with military families, yes, causing us to focus on the impact that service has on communities around us and making sure that we're focusing on their sacrifices. I think the other thing that's important is Michelle Obama continued to rise above every criticism.
And like, she got attacked.
From the moment they started campaigning, she was the angry black woman. When she said, for the first moment in my adult life, I'm proud of this country, We all related to that. There was a rousing amen corner from Black America, and the fact that it was such a point of criticism drew this very stark contrast that only grew throughout his presidency. I think the other thing is being criticized on your appearance. And for us, it's like every time she
enters
a room,
you had Republicans sitting out stuff calling her monkey and ape, all sort of stuff. I mean, and then to the whole point, Jason, dealing with this issue of angry Black woman, Glenn Beck was out there as well.
Amazing.
I mean, she caught a level of flack that no other first lady had ever gotten.
And yet, you know what was funny? The Republicans got caught on their own bigotry when it came to Michelle. You remember the Sensenbrenner story? He was caught at a retirement home and he was making fun of Michelle Obama, and a 78-year-old white woman pulled him over and said, "I love her. You're not going to say." Working class white people love them some Michelle Obama in a way that I think a lot of people in Washington didn't understand. That military families work she did, that was North Carolina. That's why Obama did so well in Georgia. 20%, over 20% of the women in the Army are African American. When she was going out there and doing work for military families, she was doing work for Black women, she was doing work for working class white women. Fantastic political and policy
impact. I agree with you. I mean, it's interesting because we're talking about a trained lawyer who her husband used to work for.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, but let's go back to the HBCU thing for a moment. Contrast Barack Obama's finger waving, including at Howard, by the way, I was there for that one, with Michelle Obama at Bowie State and Tuskegee. I mean, Michelle Obama very quietly, in fact, in some ways, she was his Black beard.
Yes.
In other words, I mean, on the seriously, in terms of our communities, forget the working class white folks for a minute. In terms of our communities, she was the person whose presence sent a signal that there's some Blackness in the White House. I mean, Michelle Obama was very calculated.
I always said he was Uncle Phil and she was Aunt Viv. She was the first Aunt Viv.
Hold up, Lauren.
I think Michelle Obama really was incredible during these 8 years. I mean, I can't think of one thing that she did that was embarrassing, that was the wrong move, that was the wrong tenor. Right.
She had
humor.
Who also, remember the video with LeBron James and those guys?
Right.
I mean, you saw a personality from a first lady you had not seen.
The Garden.
And she's doing
my mother loved
that. I know. I mean, the Vera Wang and the J. Crew, to me, it was a perfect first ladyship. You know, we've had some wacky stuff coming out of the First Lady's
and
office,
about
right?
Wait till
we
Melania
gets
in.
Reagan with the astrology,
and
we had some
Nazis,
but. Michelle Obama was really near perfect.
Okay, now I'll disagree with Greg on this whole idea that somehow the level of Blackness. I mean, so I disagree with you on that one. But in terms of when she did go out, she actually spoke a lot more openly about the issue of race and legacy.
This is an important one.
You got 30 seconds.
During the convention when she said that her daughters are playing on the lawn of a house built by slaves, it was a perfect closure to something that's been hard. They've struggled to talk about race, and she did it so eloquently.
Right. Even though if I was one of the people who worked on the building, that'd have been like, I really don't want you to bring that up.
All right, y'all, we come back. My final thoughts on the legacy of President Barack Obama.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Well, for the last 8 years, TV One has been the only network that has had either Sunday show or a daily show that has covered every aspect of the Obama presidency. First, it was Washington Watch, we had from 2009 to 2013, and then for the last 3 years, News One Now. We have covered the highs and the lows. We've only interviewed President Barack Obama once in the White House, January 2010. We've only interviewed First Lady Michelle Obama once in the White House. It took place in late 2010 for her Let's Move initiative. Both of those were prime time specials. You know, the course of those 8 years, for us, it's been about the symbolism, but it's also been about the policy. And for us, that's important for African Americans that we must look at both of those. Yes, we felt good. We were all empowered. What it meant to see a Black family as the first family. But as we open this up, it also is how do we stand now 8 years after a first Black president? What are the lessons we can learn? I'll be perfectly clear. The most important lesson that we can learn is we have to learn how to speak to politicians that even if you are the first, he was also the 44th. And I believe in many cases, African Americans, especially civil rights groups, got caught up in the first and not the 44th. Our job is to hold every president, every governor, every state rep, every state senator, every county commissioner, every county judge, every mayor, every council member, every clerk accountable when it comes to our community. There are a number of things that we are excited and happy about. It was important for this country, it is important for this country to have an African American as president of the United States. But it's more important for us to understand that he is leaving the White House, but our issues remain. We must remain on the wall. We must remain on guard, and that is fighting for our issues, because what we fight for today impacts our children's children. This is not just about how do you do something for the record books. It's also how do you ensure the next generation of African Americans will have a future. We thank President Barack Obama for his work. We thank First Lady Michelle Obama for her work as well. As they leave the White House, we salute them. But let me be clear, I don't believe this is the last time we're going to see a black president or a black first lady. That means some of us got to keep doing the work. Folks, be sure to get a copy of my book, The First, President Barack Obama's Road to the White House, the coverage of his campaign. The interviews that we showed you from with Michelle Obama and Barack Obama is on the DVD there as well, including a lot of inside stories about stuff you didn't know that happened behind the scenes. You also can hear the insights from people like Spike Lee, Malik Yoba, Erica Alexander, and others talking about what it meant to be behind the campaign of President Barack Obama. Folks, that is it for us. Only more 4 more hours left in his presidency. Enjoy it while you can, because I'm telling you right now, when it comes to the 45th presidency of Donald Trump, right here on TV One, News One Now, we will hold him accountable. And as my frat brother Vertner Woods and Tandy said, we will fight until hell freezes over, and then we will fight on the ice. Have a good day.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.